time you leave. Cause darling, I'm a nightmare dressed like a daydream.
So it's gonna be forever.
So you want to talk about this weird, complicated, overstuffed book?
Yeah. I was reading it last night and going, did I like this when I was a kid? Because I sure don't like it now.
I don't remember it. I don't remember anything about it.
I remember exactly one thing from it, which was...
Tax on poop?
No. No. The coffee shop. Like, that was it. That was all that I remember is the coffee shop scene where Tobias morphs Taylor, and there's two Taylors.
Oh, yeah. And a Borders.
Oh, God.
That whole chapter, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but that whole chapter where they have to use the internet, or the net, as they call it, to go to http://www.earthisours.com and then acts like says Earthosaurus.
Somehow I didn't remember that. It's the kind of thing that would have stuck.
I
feel like that sort of little stupid detail, but I didn't remember that at all.
I loved it so much. But that chapter was a little 90s homage.
When they got to the website, I was like, wait a sec. Is this like a web form they're submitting like the way we would do now? Or is it what I prefer to think and what I choose to believe, which is a guest book.
Yes. Oh my God. It was a guest book. They were on like a GeoCities site. There were like, there was like a repeating pattern, like 8-bit background, like with like
yeah,
a twinkle.
Yeah. Cause they know how long like the photo of Earth takes to load. I'm like, oh God, that was dark ages.
And they fished that laptop out of a dumpster. And then Cassie's cell phone that she could only use for half an hour of talking during the week was the other parts of it. It was such a beautiful little relic of a time and just nestled in this book. This is the highlight of the book for me.
Yeah, honestly, there were several, you know, mid to late 90s moments. And that definitely was the best. The best part was the 90s gauge for this particular volume.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely miss Borders.
Yeah, RIP Borders.
Tobias's Borders was kind of hopping. There
yeah,
was like an author
reading
going
yeah.
on. Like, there were never author readings at Borders.
That was, truly. Well, so that's in one thing. There were a few things in this book that I was like, I don't entirely find this, like, plausible. Or if it is truly happening, it is not a good idea. And one of them was, like, how many conversations they had about, like, the Yerkes and, like, the plan and controllers, like, in public. In crowded places, like this Borders, and like the mall food court later on in the book, when Cassie was like rejecting the plan and like stood up and started to kind of like draw attention. They're like, no, Cassie, don't draw attention to the fact that we're talking about alien invasions in the middle of a food court. Maybe don't talk about alien invasions in the middle of a food court.
Yeah, because I feel like other books have established that when they talk on the phone, at least, like, they're always like talking in code, like the David Letterman thing for at some point. Which, and, you know, it's always couched as, like, you never know who's listening. I'm like, yeah, and to be fair, in public, I mean, you hear all kinds of wacky things. But there's also assholes like me who are literally listening to your conversation because
mm-hmm.
they think it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. If
and
you
also,
hear the word,
they need writing fodder.
If you hear the word, like, if you hear so many, heard so many weird words like yerk and, like, I don't know, alien or controller, come on now, you would pique some interest.
The minute I hear people talking about aliens in public, I am automatically listening to them.
Exactly.
Like, if only to see how wacky it gets.
Exactly.
And if it got to that point where, like, there were words I didn't recognize, you know, I would absolutely be wondering, like,
mm-hmm.
what on earth those children are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What do the youth know that I don't know?
I feel like nowadays they could get, maybe then, I don't know anything about anything, but I feel like the real guys would be, like, just bring, like, a tabletop game with them so that it would always seem like they were talking about, like, a fantasy world. Like, that's the way to do it.
That's brilliant, actually. To my understanding of tabletop games.
Exactly. I have no understanding of tabletop
Which
games,
I
but...
I think there is an Animorphs one now. Somebody made one, or wrote one.
All right. Okay. All right. Now's the time to learn.
Yeah, into that kind of thing? It's probably pretty cool.
Probably. Well, so, there were a handful of things in this book that... That level of, like, caution that you just described of, like, are the phones tapped? Like, they kind of went through the motions of that, but then still were just like, okay, it's fine. We're going to keep doing this thing. And as a reader, it felt a little bit like,
Is it?
Because it seems like it shouldn't be. And, like, and I don't know if it's just, you know, the reader knowing that, like, danger is likely coming, or if it's a matter of, like, oh, this was kind of flimsily held up to be able to put forth the plot that you wanted in this book to make the things happen that you wanted. Like, seeing the, you know, the wiring or whatever. Because, like, yeah, a lot happened in this book, and it did, to me, kind of go, like, did it need to happen? Like, why is this happening? Like, what, why is this being tied together the way it's being tied together? This is a Tobias book, as you probably already knew, and he, it starts, because there's always the thing in the beginning, you know, the initial chapter rescue, or, you know, morphing parrots to, what do they do? They just save the birds, shut down the parrots' abuse?
They were, as I recall, they were trying to, like, what, shame the restaurant owner into not having parrots?
Yes, I love it. That's a Cassie and Marco plan if I've ever heard it. And gone are the days when Cassie and Marco are going to get together on the same page, probably the same kind of plan. But Tobias, his initial thing is on his own, and he saves a little kid who is deaf, who has been lost in the woods, and in doing so, like, makes him and the Animorphs, like, vulnerable, because there are headlines that say, like, talking hawk leads man to sun in woods, which, again, this was something that I feel like he could have done another way. He could have done something other than being like, hello, I'm a hawk, don't ask questions, I know where your kid is. Like, times were dire, yes, there was a storm, but I feel like, you know, could you morph and then, like, leave a note at the police station?
Exactly. I'm like, you know what, Tobias, you have more supposable thumbs. Write it down, go away again.
Exactly. Like, or call it tip, in. Anonymous tip. Yes. Like, you could totally do that. But he didn't. He appeared as a magical talking bird to both Bobby, the child, and Bobby's father, the adult. And then there were headlines, and so then he was captured. And there was never really any more fallout on the fact that there were headlines about a mystical talking hawk who saved a kid. Like, that didn't come up again in the book. It sort of was like, he created this, like, media chaos that then we were, like, jettisoned away from and into the actual plot line.
Yeah. I feel like if they, you know, if the ghostwriter had wanted to drop that immediately, it probably would have been a little bit more plausible in every way if, I don't actually think that's the kind of thing that the local news would report. I do think it's the kind of thing that like, the National Enquirer would report, which is, you know, automatically bullshit, right? And nobody would care about, except maybe Yerkes.
Sure. Yeah.
So,
no, that's true. Well, that's, yeah.
It's sort of a weird opening frame, and it did feel kind of forced, I thought.
Well,
a lot of this book felt forced.
Yeah, I would agree with that, unfortunately. I think the one and the first chapter, Tobias was, like, in his head, and, like, we got a lot of, like, broody Tobias in this book, and I do think that, I guess, was it the last Tobias outing, the Taylor outing? Was that the very last time we talked to Tobias? Was that the last time he narrated?
It must have been, which I don't love this one being the one after that, frankly.
I like the idea that, obviously, the experience of being, I like the idea of bringing into the story the idea that, obviously, if he was tortured, that is not something that you just walk away from unscathed. And I think that is definitely a worthy pursuit. The fact that it, like, tormented him, and then he ended up kind of back in the same situation, didn't feel like exactly, I wouldn't have wanted to do that if I were the author. I wouldn't have wanted to subject Tobias to the exact same, like, trauma, given that he was clearly, like, fixated on it in the beginning of the book, and then just to have Rachel in the end sort of be like, you know, the past is the past, let it go. Like, I don't think that's, like, quite the arc that I would want and the message that I would want to put into this.
Yeah, and the situation that, you know, that comes up with Taylor, both, I mean, it is initially immediately similar in, you know, her threatening him again, and, like, you know, I would torture you again right now if I could, but I haven't, you know, there's a game plan. And then, you know, what is supposed to be, like, the moral arc is something that we've already done, which, you know, is referenced repeatedly as Cassie in the peace movement, which has happened, like, twice now, and both in better books.
Yes.
And so there's two things that have already happened, already been addressed in, like, very similar ways, and without, like, I don't know. I didn't get any kind of real emotional impact from this, which is unusual because it's a Tobias book, and he has most of the emotions.
It's true. It's true. I feel personally like I have a harder time connecting to Tobias, which I don't know why that is. And then when I was reading this book, I was like, maybe it's me. Like, maybe I'm not, like, getting it. I don't know. The thing with Cassie, I didn't like how background it was. Like, you get the sense that, like, by the end of the, like, Cassie suffered a great trauma at the end of this book because of the actions of the other Animorphs. And the fact that we just sort of skirted along the fringes of that is, like, kind of crazy to me.
Yeah, it feels a little cheap, too, because she bows out of, like, the plan,
yes,
like, basically in the middle of the book, once they decide what they're going to do, and she's like, I can't, I have to sit this out, and then she ends up, you know, having to be the savior in a violent way at the end, which, you know, if we, like, again, this is an emotional journey that we've had in some of her perspective books, and you know, the sort of thing that has been thrown at her, like, by the droid, the, like, Cassie the killer with a conscience and all that.
Yeah.
Like, we have visited all of this and in various places, and it's all being sort of, like, put together in this one place to not great effect.
It's true. Well, because it was shitty of the Animorphs to put her in that position. Like, because the mechanisms of the plot felt kind of forced, as the reader, you're thinking, they don't have to do this. You're like Amy Poehler with that Free Solo rant. I'm like, you don't have to do this.
Yeah,
and then no one is making you. And in the end, Rachel made it seem like, you know, this had to happen, like some good came out of it. And I didn't really follow her logic either, and it made Rachel seem more like a sociopath, which I know is where Rachel's headed, but again, this isn't necessary. Like, the last few pages of the book to, like, make Tobias feel better about a trauma that Cassie suffered on top of a trauma that Tobias has already suffered, like, twice now. Like, it did not feel like the best deployment of those dynamics.
Yeah, definitely that. And the Cassie is, like, the deus ex machina has happened that, like, pretty much the exact same thing happens with Eric the Chi, and it was honestly much more dramatic then.
True,
because Cassie is a human and she always has free will, and this is something that has been, you know, discussed endlessly, usually by her, you know, the idea of making choices, whereas when Eric does that, he literally has to rewire himself to do it, and it's wild and, like, really, really, you know, is kind of a whammy. And that's not something
too
that you get to, like, necessarily kind of ape again later.
Yeah.
To similar effect, but, like, much diminished. Because, you know, that's what I'm going to think of. That's what that calls back to.
Yeah.
And in this particular book, in this particular plot, which is not one of the more convincing plots, I don't think. Yeah, the whole time I'm not convinced that they need to be doing any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens at the end is like, This is not good for anybody. Like, nobody seems to have really grown or changed.
Yeah.
And they're all just suffering.
Yeah. Because even some of the character stuff, like in the beginning, like when Tobias is, like, flying in the storm and he's in his head, and, like, the voice of Taylor is in his head a lot in this book, and it's, like, taunting him and telling him he's weak and diminishing him, and it seemed like they were trying to make an emotional through line between that voice being in his head, him rescuing Bobby McIntyre but not thinking it through, him going through with the plan, and, like, a few of Tobias's choices are, like, emotional moments, it seemed like they were sort of hanging them on the trauma from Taylor, and it I can't think of any specific examples right now, which is not helping my argument, but it didn't feel completely earned. Like, I didn't follow his logic, and I was like, well, like, maybe that's, like, maybe I'm not, like, you know, being open-minded enough, or, like, imagining, you know, I'm not putting myself in his shoes enough, or, like, I'm being prescriptive about, like, what trauma can lead, you know, people to do and their decisions. But also, you know, this is being written by a ghostwriter who's trying to make the plot do certain things, so I guess we should explain a little bit of what the plot was doing, because there's a plan in this, as always.
It's very... I don't know. There are a lot of points to the plan.
So Taylor comes to them with an offer. So she gets Tobias, who she thinks is an Andalite. That's another thing that felt like, how could you have sustained this for so long? Like, them morphing so much near Taylor, or like in her plan, without her like noticing. But like, it's like Tobias hid behind Jake and then morphed into a hawk and then into an Andalite. It's like, you know. You guys.
The weird thing, something that really caught me off guard was after he's initially captured by her, he has some weird moment where he hopes that she doesn't realize who he is. And I'm like, why would you think that?
Yeah.
Like, you guys always morph the same goddamn things. Like, everybody knows that everybody has a morph that they really like. And, like, if by this point they think that you're still Andalites somehow, like, they still know that everybody has a favorite. And if she sees a hawk, she remembers who you are, dude. Like, why would you even think that?
Yeah, and you're a hawk most of the time. Like, it's not...
You're a hawk by this point. Like, you're a hawk, buddy.
Yeah.
And she's not going to think, like, oh, I captured the same kind of hawk as I did last time.
Yeah.
But it's probably not the same actual Andalite, air quote.
Yeah, that was kind of absurd. And the other thing that you saying that made me think of, one thing that felt kind of odd was Tobias dredging up becoming a hawk in a lot of his self-doubt and his, like, was I weak in becoming a hawk? And was I, and I don't, admittedly, again, I don't remember, I feel like this has been addressed before in his books in the past. Like, we're at book number 43, so he's had probably, like, 6 at this point.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that there's multiple instances where he's remembering what it was like. And when they go back to the Urkul, and which is, you know, the site of him becoming trapped in morph, like, sure, okay, you're probably going to think about that.
Yeah.
But a lot of the other instances and a lot of his other, like, interior monologue, yeah, it feels like something that Tobias of 6 books ago would have been thinking about.
Yeah.
And by now he has other concerns, and his, you know, his character has moved on in a lot of interesting ways, I think.
Yeah.
That usually involve Axe and Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he mentions Elfanger, like, once, I think.
Yeah, just once.
But the previous Taylor book, which I think is really good.
I remember liking that one.
Does way more interesting things with, like, Tobias and his status between, you know, human and Andalite and Hawk.
Mm-hmm.
And this one just, it felt kind of warmed over in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And, like, pulling pieces that were already established and sort of, like, you know, not developing them further.
I don't remember if we had any, like, criticism of the first Taylor book and of the way the Taylor is portrayed as sort of the, like, teen sociopath queen bee stereotype, kind of. Like, the pretty girl, like, the deranged pretty girl, I guess. But elements of it in this book felt a little, like, tiresome to me. And
I remember being more bothered by, and I think I remember that we talked about, her disability.
Yes. It was,
that,
it felt,
that trope.
It felt worse in this book.
It definitely does.
They kept talking, like, Tobias kept saying about her choice to be beautiful. And I was like, oh no.
And, like, and when he morphs her, like, his comparison when they're in the coffee shop together of, like, you know, how she, yeah, it was, I was reading it and going, there are some interesting things that I would like to think about in terms of a presumably cis boy who becomes a hawk. And it's also part alien morphing a very beautiful girl. Like, there's some interesting things you could think about in that way.
There's some unpacking there.
In that realm. But the book is not doing that, obviously, because it's written for 11-year-olds. But also, like, It's written for 11-year-olds. It doesn't need to be doing what it's doing either.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Taylor stuff in this book, and it, she felt much more one-dimensionally, like, oh, she's evil, or she is, like,
yeah, even mentally the descriptions
not
of
right, like, yeah.
The interplay between the York host and Taylor, the way that was described really bothered me. Because, like, that relationship is always really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of the books, especially the ones that deal with Yorks as people and who want things that aren't what Visser 3 wants, like, it's been done really interestingly.
Yeah.
And in this case, it just wasn't.
And they...
And it, yeah, it really, you know, it trades on things that are, that we would now consider really tired and, like, kind of offensive.
Yeah. Well, and they even dangled the carrot of, like, Taylor wants, like, a democratic society. Taylor is working with, like, you know, the peace movement, Taylor. And, like, and they question, they're like, there's no way. And Marco is like, people are always who they are. Like, she's not doing any of that. But they still went along with it. And then in the end, it was like, no, she was working for Visser 3. And they were trying to take out the Andalite bandits and the peace movement on the same night at the York pool, because all the Andalites, all of the peace people, like, go to the York feeding together, which doesn't seem like a super great plan. This is another thing that's like, you guys, this is not the smartest way to do that. Come on now.
Yeah, honestly, any guerrilla group knows to not do that.
It's any, like, horror movie. Don't cluster, spread out.
The dumbest president of the United States does not fly in the same plane as the vice president. Like, it's a thing.
It's true.
That you don't do.
Exactly. Horror movies, actually, it's probably the opposite. You probably should stick together in horror movies. But in every other case,
yes,
don't cluster.
Split up. That's why, like, any revolutionary group has what are called cells. Like, and this is something that has been established in more than one Animorphs book previously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think at some point someone assumes that there's more than one group of Andalites on Earth operating in cells, which would be great if true, but it's not.
I like how you're thinking of, like, very high-level, like, strategic things, and, like, my brain went to horror movies, and then that Brooklyn Nine-Nine thing that's, like, don't, like, cluster like you're not Gazelle or whatever. That's what my brain thinks. It's like, you're not Gazelle. You're drawing attention to yourself.
There's just multiple points in this book where I'm like, nobody would do what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, I'm not a great plotter.
I'm not either.
By any stretch.
Me neither.
It is not my strong point. And I generally don't go in for, like, oh, this is a plot hole, like, in films. Mm-hmm. I don't really care.
Me neither.
But the Animorphs wouldn't have any good reason to do what they did.
It's true.
And the peace movement inside the Yorks on Earth also wouldn't have done what they did.
Mm-hmm.
The only person who would have done what they did is Visser 3, because that's what he always does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they know that. Like, they know that.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing was all just, like, none of this needed to happen, and you're hanging it on, like, weird, warmed-up, like, emotional arcs for Tobias, for Cassie, and for Rachel in ways that, like, aren't fully earned and aren't reaching the potential of all the, like, amazingness that those three individually have with, like, their characters.
There's not a lot of Jake in this book. By this point in his character arc, like, yes, he is willing to kill a lot of innocents. Like, I believe that. B, I think that he's self-aware enough to not be like, oh, but this isn't the same thing as bombing a mall.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it is. Everybody's on the same page with this. You guys know what you're doing. Like, I wish that you didn't have to know what you're doing, because you're only, like, 14. But still,
that's,
you know.
Well, that's part of what makes Animorphs so good, is that they do know what they're doing, and they, it's still the better choice, question mark? That's part of the conversation, and that's part of the, like, trauma. That's part of the, like, inherent, like, upsettingness of Animorphs as a YA book series, is that they are in these situations where they have to make these calls, and they are aware of the cost, they are aware of the sacrifices, and a lot of times they still have to do it.
This is not one of those times, though.
It's true. I was about to say, sometimes maybe they don't. Like,
yeah, like, I'm sorry, but it was not convincingly deployed to me that they would have thought that they needed to go along with Taylor's plan.
Yeah. What if you just don't climb it? Like.
And I wasn't convinced that, I mean, I guess there's something to be said narratively for, like, what amounts to, I guess, immersion therapy of Tobias interacting with Taylor again.
Mm.
But I don't necessarily think that translates to, and I want to believe she's become a better person.
No.
Like, do you have any evidence that she has? Other than her, like, lying to your face, which she's very obviously doing.
Yeah, well, and I didn't even really get, I don't know. I don't think I got the sense that Tobias, like, I don't know, did anybody want to believe that? That she, I don't know. It's all
murky. I mean, I suppose Cassie would objectively want to believe that you can become a better person.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, move on from torturing people for a living.
Sure.
But in this specific case, like, I think even if, like, Taylor's plan hadn't been an act of terrorism against a defenseless group of people who probably have, like, you know, non-combatants in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That she, there wouldn't, there's no, nobody would have been invested, there was no reason for them to be invested in it, other than, like, sort of a sense of self-preservation, because, like, oh, she can out us, basically. She can, like, land us with Wizard 3, but, like, that's always been true.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing, too. It was, the flimsy argument was, like, we're doing this because that means we can get Wizard 3. And it's like, does it? And that's the thing, is that, like, the best Animorphs books, even though they result in a little bit of deus ex machina in the end, because it's a serialized thing and has to keep going, but, like, most Animorphs books are ones where they're on their back heel, where, like, they're not the ones who are like, oh, we have a plan to, like, take a knock at the enemy. It's like, the enemy has a plan to take a knock at us, and we are doing last-minute measures to just hang on. Which is the whole thesis of the
offense,
exactly. Like, it's the whole thesis of the book series. They're the last defense, and so they're always just scrapping to, like, keep the territory they have, essentially. And like, maybe that's part of it, is that they, like, having read 42 plus books at this point, is that structure, that, like, narrative, you know, device is, like, implanted in our brains, that if we read a book where it's like, so they're going to team up with, like, a torturing, like, terrorist lady that they know has, like, caused them harm before to have a plan to take a knock at their enemy. Like, none of that feels like an Animorphs plot, and that, I think, maybe rang some of the alarms as well on a, like, a higher level.
Yeah, because, I mean, you could see, or assuming that you were reading this for the first time, you might, you know, say, okay, at some point they are going to start playing offense, because you can morally say that if your planet is being invaded, like, it's okay to do what you need to do offensively and not just, you know, put out fires as they start.
Sure, how are you
supposed
to be
in it? And at some point, like, a group has to do that.
Sure.
And I think that's an interesting conversation that the books are about to have, because they are, I know that.
Okay.
But it's not effectively raised here, and it's not really couched that way, even by, like, Cassie or Marco, who are the two that you would assume would be having that argument.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and if this, again, my memory of anything is a little bit shoddy, but if this is the first instance of you know, us starting to address being on the offense, then this is not a great way to introduce that. This is not a good first, like, stab at that dynamic shift, or that strategy shift.
No, and honestly, like, it's not even a particularly good Killing Visser 3 book.
No.
There have definitely been better ones.
Snake in the Grass, hello. That's
Snake
the
in
classic.
The Grass is amazing because of the twist.
Mm-hmm.
Because Visser 3 gets away, and then you're confronted with, Axe is confronted with a member of his own species who is free. Like, that's beautiful Animorphs work.
Mm-hmm.
Stellar.
Chef's kiss.
Chef's kiss Animorphs work. So good. And this is not. Visser 3 doesn't even appear.
No.
Like, this is not about him. It's supposed to be about something else, but what that is not clear to me.
No, and he's in his role, as it's sort of revealed in the end, he's like a puppet master, and Visser 3 is never really best deployed in these series as a puppet master. He's best deployed as, like, a messy bitch, tyrannical, like...
Yes, he's like, a big, dramatic, big bad. Like, exactly. That's who he is, and the puppet master character is always Visser 1,
mm-hmm.
and it's always more effective,
mm-hmm.
and if Taylor wants to be a puppet master, she's really bad at it.
Yeah.
So...
It did feel a little bit like this was trying to... I don't know, like, they're of the big bads in Animorphs. Like, you know, there's Visser 3, Visser 1, Krayak. And then this felt like an attempt to make, like, a recurring, like, another main villain recur. It's like...
I don't remember if we talked about Glory when we talked about Taylor in the first Taylor book. But...
Oh my god.
I mean, that's what I was thinking about this time, because, you know, Glory is probably not anybody's favorite Buffy villain.
Mm.
She's kind of, and that, honestly, that's how I felt about Taylor, like, in general, is that she's sort of fun to watch. Ultimately, like, what is actually, what's going on there?
She's a
there
lot of
things. Doesn't seem to be anything, like, ethos-wise, I guess.
Yeah.
And, honestly, a loose cannon is not ever the best character.
It seems a little bit like a cop-out, because you can just sort of rely on chaos is what, and make them do whatever you want that's chaotic.
Yeah, it's almost like, I was thinking about Avril Lavigne this week, because there's a new Avril Lavigne music video, which you may have seen.
I haven't.
Actually, like, pretty good. Anyway, but I was thinking about, like, mall goth tropes, essentially.
I love where this is going. I'm so happy that we're doing this right now. Please continue.
And the whole, like, the now cliche, or at the time cliche, because we've certainly moved past this culturally, but what will be familiar to anybody who was a teenager at that time of being like, I'm so random, you know? Of, like, saying that you're random, which automatically cancels out the randomization, right?
Yes.
Honestly, that's what Taylor kind of reminds me of.
Like, she should be wearing one of those, like, one of the, like a baby doll.
The bias is cute but psycho.
Yes. I was, okay, yes. Like, that is exactly where I was going. The, like, baby doll t-shirt with, like, the insult bunny on it or whatever. Like, that's exactly what Taylor should be wearing, with, like, flare jeans and, like one, like, really chunky highlights, maybe. And, like, a leather armband, like a cuff.
And I say this with all love, because obviously I'm still watching Avril Lavigne music videos, but, like, remember that at some point in the book, Taylor shows up, I guess, to, like, you know, for a meeting or whatever, or, like, to implement the plan, and she's, like, wearing leather.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what year was this written?
Yeah.
And also, Axe wouldn't be staring.
No.
Axe does not understand why this is weird. Tobias, sure. But
yeah.
Axe doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, Taylor felt... Yeah, just much, much flatter this time, and, like, much tropier in ways that were not beneficial to her character. And, like, and I remember the first time around, Tobias and the narrative both drew a lot of parallels between Taylor and Rachel, and this time, not so much. Like, it flattened each of them in slightly different ways, and it was just like, well, and I don't know that the book would have been better if there were comparisons between Taylor and Rachel. Like, that's, I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I'm just trying to think of the way that they portrayed Taylor last time and how it was maybe a little bit more three-dimensional, and maybe it was because they tethered her to Rachel a little bit, and that helped make it interesting.
I think so, and I think that's part of why she shouldn't have been used again as a character, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Because you only get to do that once, mm-hmm. and... By several books later, you have to at least believe that Tobias and Rachel have both changed, like, and grown.
Hopefully.
As a result, I'm sure, of what happens to Tobias and how that probably changes his feelings about Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you encounter what is essentially the Dark Willow version of your girlfriend, like, you're probably not going to be able to separate that necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there wasn't really a lot of that in here.
They hardly interacted.
And there wasn't, he didn't really dwell on the two of them as, like, you know, a binary.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
yeah.
Again, like you said, I don't know if it would have been better if he had, or if it would have been worse. But it's just more feel for my belief that I don't think that this was the best next to Vi's book, was having her appear again, because you really, I think you, that's the kind of thing you can only really effectively capitalize on once.
Well, and by nature, you know, again, I think it is valuable to have the continuity of remembering that Tobias was tortured, remembering that that will have character effects, and, like, not just rinsing and repeating the next time he swings around in the narrative, but I think that's an inherent challenge with the books being formatted the way that they are, where, like, we've had six books, or five books, or whatever, with different narratives between these two Tobias books, and to have to swing back around, and, like, as a reader, you feel like a lot of time has passed, you've, like, seen a lot more things between the last time we talked to Tobias, but then to then have to sort of say, okay, we're gonna revisit the thing that affected him last time, not just in an emotional arc, but in, like, an actual plot arc again, it feels... It's just, it's hard to get back on board with that, I think.
And if we take as accurate that Rachel is deteriorating somewhat, which she is, then, I mean, I guess you could naturally say that Taylor is also deteriorating, and she seems to be. Mm. But they're not, you know, they're not starting from the same place.
No.
And so, yeah, I don't think it was effective really in any way. Yeah. Which is unfortunate, because, sure, I mean, Tobias experienced something really profound and profoundly awful that you would think changes, you know, most of his relationships. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't... The whole thing felt thin. Like, all of the scenes of, like, the gang together wasn't the best writing ever.
Yeah.
I will say.
Yeah. Yeah, it hung together pretty loosely. And, like, and just so much, there was so much, like, plausible deniability to try and get over that hump. Like, even just, like, being able to conquer the taxon mind and, like, carry...
We talked about the taxons.
Yeah, we haven't even, we totally skirted the whole plot of the book and talking about its flaws. Many apologies. We'll try and do it now, like 20 minutes later after we said we were going to do it the first time. So the plot of the book, the proposition that Taylor brings to them is like, I want a democratic New York society, obviously, that's totally believable. And in order to do that, I want to take out the Yerk pool. I don't know what reason they gave that that was like the thing to do. But her plan is to dig a tunnel from like the gas plant. I'm really revealing how little I know about, honestly, when the gas, like, I was just like, wait, is this liquid gas or, like air gas? Like, I had a real science problem for a second.
I did think it was supposed to be natural gas, although at some point at the end when they're like, and Cassie turned the gas off, I'm like, did she? Is that physically possible in this context? Because what was supposed to happen was a giant gas explosion.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of like, oh, I left my kitchen burner on.
Yes, I have no idea. If anyone works for like City Works or like has more just like practical everyday knowledge. Yeah. Please tell us what the hell we're supposed to, I don't think it matters ultimately, but I definitely had like brain confusion as I was reading this, and then I felt very disappointed that I like didn't really know that it hadn't occurred to me that the word we use for like gas, like solid liquid gas, that some gas in our language is liquid, and I was just like, what have we done? You've rendered me completely confused, English. But anyways, so the plan is to dig a tunnel to make it so that, yeah, you put a bunch of natural gas in the Yerk pool and then blow it up and kill a lot of people in one fell swoop. And everyone's like, yes, great plan. This is definitely worth it. We should definitely do it. Cassie is like, no, not great plan. I don't want to do it. So she sits this one out so that she can go play the hero at the end. I mean, obviously, again, it's a shitty thing for the Animorphs to do to her within the narrative, and then narratively kind of a shitty thing to do to Cassie. So the plan is to morph taxons, because taxons will eat the dirt. And then as they started the plan, I was like, presumably they have to poop that all out. And is it not at the same volume? Like, are they not just going to fill the tunnel back in with taxon poop as they keep going? Yeah.
It was a real, real dreadful, like,
So gross.
My asthma in my mind of, like, human centipede.
Yes, and you're in a tunnel, like, claustrophobia, like, weird.
There's an image at some point of how taxons, like, chill out, which is basically just a giant mound of, like, taxons, like, sleeping on each other. And I'm like, everything about this is terrible in hindsight.
Truly. Like, then they were like, access the hibernation state. And I was like, oh, like, a hibernation state that will lead to calmness, like, meditating, like, a happy place. And then it was a pile of human bodies. And I was like, oh, no. Oh no, that is not okay. So, yeah. So taxons are living nightmares. Axe, like, they have to drag Axe out because he just starts, like, eating in a circle and, like, makes a weird, like, tunnel, like, cavern in the middle of the tunnel as well. Taylor, like, betrays them a few times. She tries to shoot Tobias, but luckily Axe, like, set her phasers to stun. Her blaster was only for, like, level 3. Dracon beam, thank you, to level 3. I had to get my right, I had to jump from Star Trek to Star Wars to Animorphs.
Before finally landing on the correct intergalactic handheld weapon.
Exactly, apologies. So it was just kind of a shit show, literally, as well as narratively. And eventually, Tobias is the one that breaks through into the Yerk pool. And, like, makes it through some stone. And then Taylor, like, betrays them again and is like, I've stunned all your friends and I'm here to, like, ask you to, like, infest your body as an Andalite to, like, I don't know. Side note, another really dumb thing for plausibility, the fact that, like, every time Tobias morphed an Andalite, Axe had to give him a haircut. I'm like, this is so not practical, like, you guys.
We have more important things to worry about than why you look exactly the same.
Seriously.
Like, calm down.
And your fur is going to be on the ground now? Like, this is just so not practical. Anywho, that just...
Plus, like, I have to say, if there was a carbon copy of me right now who happened to have long hair, like, we would still look the same. It's just hair. Unless Axe is, like, really, really furry... This has never been established that he looks like one of those unshorn sheep that get loose occasionally. You've seen that photo, right?
Yes.
It wouldn't make that much of a difference.
Is my point. Probably not. That umshweet is not doing anything. Yeah.
It's also not a convincing Andalite word.
No, it's not.
In my opinion.
We're being so hard on this book.
I feel kind of resentful of it. I'm sorry, aww, but I do.
Aww. So she tries to, like, ask Tobias to be like, join me and we'll rule the galaxy, blah, blah, blah. But democratically, you guys, don't worry.
The number of times democracy happens in this book is honestly kind of improbable. I feel like, for one thing, that the Yerks don't necessarily have that concept and wouldn't use that word.
No.
I mean, maybe they have, like, been reading the Earth Civics books and are like, hey, this is actually pretty cool. But we can probably do it better.
It's like,
well, the U.S.
Honestly, at first I thought it'd be funny, and then I was like, well, this actually probably would be apt that, like, the Yerk peace movement is made up of, like, middle schoolers and high schoolers because they're taking like, U.S. government, or, like, they're taking, like, civics classes. The students are the revolution.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, that's something that's always interesting to me in these books is the flow of information between host and Yerk.
Mm-hmm.
It's some, you know, that obviously that comes up in certain ways, but yeah, if you infest a high schooler and they have to go to school every day, like, inevitably the Yerk is going to learn a lot of things that it wouldn't otherwise. And sometimes that happens in funny ways, like when John Barryman is tormenting his Yerk with Shakespeare. But in this case, like, yeah, I was more politically aware between the ages of 14 and 17 than I've probably ever been.
Yeah.
Because I was in school.
Yeah.
And also, George Bush was president.
That is fair. Yes. Anyway. These are all valid points. And I think, to your point that, like, the relationship between the host and the Yerk is always really interesting, the fact that, and you touched on this before, but the fact that we got that glimmer where the real Taylor knocked over the coffee mug at the Borders Cafe, and then, like, Taylor, like, subjugated her and, like, took her over, and then that, like, nothing ever panned out with that? Like, why did that happen? If not, like, what was the point of that? If you weren't going to make some interesting statement about, or like, if the real Taylor weren't going to show up again or like be helpful later on. The point that was sort of made was just that, like, the Yerk hadn't really had a full grip on Taylor to begin with, and, like, oh, does that mean that, like, there's more symbiosis there? Like, it was just used to, like, try and sell the fact that they should trust Taylor, and, in, like, which is not
it's,
great.
And that's so weird to me, because, like, if I were Tobias, and that was what I saw, and that was the only hint that I had of, like, their relationship, it would make me not trust her.
Exactly.
Because, like, obviously she's not interested in the peace movement and in Yerk democracy.
Yes.
Because the whole point of the established peace movement is that there are some Yerks who don't want to infest at all, and they want another option, like morphing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some Yerks who want symbiosis and want to have, like, a more equitable relationship with their host, and that the human hosts are also on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those are the two kind of, like, peace prongs, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And this is neither of them. This
No.
is exactly what you would expect from,
exactly.
From a Yerk who is really invested in Yerk hierarchy.
This is the equivalent of, like, this is the equivalent of Princess Leia wrenching free. Exactly. It's a trap. And then Luke being like, I think I'm going to go through with this. I really like my odds here. This is going to be a good plan. It's all going to go well. Like, that's what the equivalent is. It's just like, Tobias, this is not, again, humans were doing things that humans don't do. And these were situations that, like, it was hard to believe that anyone, any of these characters specifically, or honestly, just like anyone awake, would follow the path that these kids did to try and, like, make this plan happen that was a ridiculous plan to begin with.
For what is, by this point in the series, it's kind of small potatoes, honestly, because, okay, they've been trying to kill Visser 3 a lot for a while, and they never have, but they also know that his position is really tenuous. And that killing him won't necessarily do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they are on the cusp of having to do something else,
mm-hmm.
which, yes, is sensible. And so it's very hard to believe at this point that they would just be like, and the gains for this will be enough that this absurd, violent plan is worth it.
And it doesn't make sense as well that in the idea that they are going to transition to doing other stuff, like, why would they make that transition on someone else's terms? Like, why wouldn't they devise their own terms, their own strategy, their own plan to be able to, like, shift strategically in the war? Like, yeah, this whole thing is it's so hard to get on board with.
Especially since they have another, you know, they have a much more plausible and more ethically sound avenue if they do want to make a strategy shift, which is the peace movement.
Exactly.
Not Taylor.
Seriously. Yeah, the actual Yerk democracy.
Yes, actual Yerks who would like to run for Senate, please.
Yeah, seriously. So, yeah. So the plan, Taylor, I guess, like, she stuns the four Animorphs, and then Tobias has to, like, save them because they're suffocating under, like, the natural gas. I don't know. And so then he, like, does this, like, a weird, like, gas slide, like, slip and slide, where he takes his, like, dirt-filled taxon sack body and just, like, shoves these animals, these lifeless animals, out back into the area where the manhole is, and then I don't know, gets them to demorph so they can get back out of the manhole, and then, like, Taylor's gone, they don't know what happened to her, and then Cassie turned the gas off but had to kill some people to do it, some controllers, and then Rachel is like, it had to happen, we found out that the peace movement, like, we saved the peace movement, you guys, with this, like, disaster plan. It's like, okay.
They wouldn't have been in danger if you hadn't had a disaster plan in the first place.
Exactly.
Like they all would have been in the same spot at once, which is unsmart, but there wouldn't have been any explosion.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. What a frustrating take, Rachel. And it's used to couch, like, you know, closing the book on Tobias's Taylor trauma, where it's like, the past is in the past. Like, you gotta let it go. It's like, This is not
Kylo Ren.
No, and this is not the person he should be talking to about this. I don't care if it is his love interest. The person he should be talking to about this is probably Marco.
Yeah.
Like,
Like, Marco knows from trauma. Like, it's fine. He spent a book trying to kill his mom once.
Exactly. Yes. Like, oh, Marco, honey.
Marco.
Yeah. So, all in all, this book didn't quite live up to any promise that it maybe set out to have in the beginning.
And, like, it doesn't establish what happens to Taylor. Mm. And so the implication is that she can come back. I'm like, please, God.
Please don't.
Don't come back. I don't think she does. I do feel bad being sort of resentful of this. Probably in an outsized way because, sure, at the end of the day, it is an entry in a series aimed at young readers. I'm sure that I had a fine time with it the first time around.
Mm.
But I really think that the first Taylor book is really interesting. Like, mm-hmm. maybe it doesn't succeed at everything that it's trying, but it's really interesting. And it's more narratively effective. And so this one sort of diminishes that.
Yeah. I just looked up the list of Animorphs books to see, because I've, you know, we've kind of dogged on the ghostwriter here. So I kind of wanted to see who it was. And it's Ellen Giroux. And I don't say this to call her out and shame her for her work 18 or 19 years ago. That's not the point. Ellen was doing her best with what the story needed to do. But Ellen wrote the first Taylor book also, which I find interesting.
I wouldn't have thought that either.
That doesn't track necessarily to me. So I'm just curious. And Ellen has written quite a few other, ghostwritten quite a few other Animorphs books. And this one was not her first, obviously. She wrote the first Taylor book and I guess maybe that was the first one she had written. And this was the first, no, she wrote The Familiar also, which is two books ago. With Jake. And she goes on to write at least one more. Two more, I think. So, yeah, so Ellen's not, you know, she's not a noob. And she's done good work in this series before. So I think it's just a weird perfect storm of trying to make something happen that, like, didn't really need to happen at this point in the series. Or at all, perhaps.
Interesting.
Coming up next, we have The Unexpected. Ooh. Cassie is morphing a kangaroo on the cover.
No, I remember this one being really weird.
Okay, let's do it. We are up for the task. So join us for that, and we hope you enjoyed something about Animorphs number 43, the test, or our nitpicking over it. And if not, hopefully you'll enjoy the weirdness of Cassie morphing into a kangaroo. Until that time, have happy days.